Hi, this is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we're offering five conversations from episode 11, in which Michael Charlton joins Jorn, Louise, and me for a far-ranging conversation of recent studies and highlights. Plus, from the vault, a conversation from last year's EASL Congress wrap-up, offering some different thoughts about the role of MASH drugs as adjuvant therapies. This conversation includes one subject of interest contributed each by Michael, Jorn, and Louise. Michael starts by mentioning the recent JAMA publication of a small randomized controlled trial exploring the use of low-dose aspirin in biopsy-confirmed nozzle patients, which he describes as a tremendous result. This result suggests benefits in terms of both PDFF and transaminase levels from use of aspirin. Jorn provides more details about the trial, and the two agree that while there is much to learn from a randomized controlled trial and understanding the biological mechanism better, this may be a very promising development. Jorn Schottenberg goes on to discuss one issue of interest to him, the upcoming Innovations in SLD Think Tank 2024. He's excited about the changes in format and believes they'll yield unique high-value benefits. I note that Jorn and his co-chair, Jeff Lazarus, will come back to discuss the Think Tank's results during the episode that posts on May 15th. Louise mentions her constant pursuit of ways to improve prediction with FibroScan and mentions a study indicating correlation between the dietary inflammation index score and the kilopascal level on FibroScan. Investigators are exploring the use of this index in an array of non-liver diseases related to metabolic syndrome or chronic kidney disease, but the correlation to kilopascals is fairly clear. Louise would like to see research looking at a controlled attenuation parameter as well, since she can usually, as she puts it, see a fat change faster than a stiffness change. It's been a while since we did an episode with a guest where we simply talked about several issues we found important, so having Michael with us was great, and discussing these topics was fantastic. There's a lot here to think about in a lot of different topics, so just sit back, listen, learn, enjoy, and when you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group.
Michael Charlton.
There was another paper, I think you may not have seen it in, I think it was JAMA, an RCT with aspirin in patients with MASH.
Yeah.
That was a tremendous result. It had been hinted at in retrospective analyses for a while, but this was a prospective study showing a benefit in PDFF and transaminases. When you combine those two, that's a pretty good indication that there's something going on in terms of efficacy. We've already started to talk about it with patients, so that most people with MASH meet American Heart Association criteria for aspirin initiation, which is essentially one excess risk factor for ischemic heart disease, and having a BMI of X and probably having MASH is enough.
Jorn Schottenberg.
I've noticed that trial too. I just pull it up. It's a monocentric 6-month phase 2, 40 versus 40 patients. So, you know, the size is not gigantic. It's typical US dose, 81 milligrams, right? In Europe, we'd be using 100. So an MRI PDFF was minus, so it was MRS, was minus 6.6% on aspirin.
That was absolute reduction. I think the proportional reduction was quite a bit more than that, Jorn. Maybe you can look. You got it in front of you.
Minus 38 or something, mean percent difference between the two groups. So that was relevant. I mean, the interesting thing, aspirin works on thrombocytes, among other things. Maybe I envisioned them in the role of fibrogenesis, but the antisteatotic mechanisms weren't immediately clear to me, and that's what's interesting about it.
They do speculate in the paper when you go through the discussion. The papers that preceded it also speculate. It says a decent biological mechanism, I think, that's there, but PDFF is pretty good. As you know, it's a very reproducible test, so I trust it. I realize it was not a large phase 2 study. But the other thing, it's an already approved drug in people who already have an indication based on professional society guidances to have it. So it's something which we should have already been having this discussion with our patients. And now that we have some evidence of this, we should really be having this discussion with patients. Then the question is, how does this interfere with clinical trials, with efficacy of, say, resmetirom? Does it increase it? Do some of the non-responders become responders? Do some of the people, you know, who were non-progressors, do they become people who are responders now?
Roger Green.
Those are great questions we don't know the answers to, right?
No, we don't.
That's a good example of how you can ask a simple question and do something that's established. You know, there are harder trials we've been doing with biopsies and non-approved drugs. So great example of creative research question and study.
Well, people have tried aspirin with just about everything, right? But it makes sense. We always have these questions about inflammation. Aspirin is nothing anti-inflammatory.
confirmatory. Now, I doubt that's I don't think that's the entire story, but you would expect somebody at some point to say, well, why not dig around in retrospective data and then go do a prospective trial? I mean, we have enough access to data these days. Before I ask everyone else what they've been interested in this past week, Michael, anything else you want to share with us about work you've been doing or things you've been looking at that you think are particularly compelling?
I think those are the things that really jumped out as being new and exciting to me. And of course, there are data we may come to later on in the cast about FGF21s, what's emerging for them. You know, they're clearly potent agents as well. But for me, I think those were the two big events for the last few weeks.
Joern, anything you would like to share with us in terms of things you've been looking at, working on, of value or interest?
The weeks are leading up to our think tank in Barcelona. Roger, you remember we had Jeff Lazarus with us on the call one of these days, and we're really trying to engage in a whole different way and not a lecture type of workshop, but something more interactive. And so I'm very excited and looking forward to that in Barcelona. There'll be a lot of energy, great people. And I think the interaction, kept it small and a maximum way to interact and discuss data, will make it very promising.
So Jeff has signed on to come back to the podcast at the end and talk about what happened. But if there's anything more you can share about what might happen, or when you talk about interesting ways to interact with data, what you're referring to, without jumping the gun too much, that'd be great.
I will, but we should probably make this together with Jeff. Again, the format is slightly different than the typical conferences or meetings we have. We're trying to mimic the hallway conversations in more than a bidirectional way, involving a group of experts and even pulling in the audience, trying to exchange and solve some of the struggles and questions we have. I mean, there will be difference between the US and the European system now with the perspective with regards to the availability of therapy, obviously, but just having a selected and invited group of 75 participants, trying to come up with answers to big and tough questions in the realm of MASLD will be a very interesting experience. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. I don't believe Jeff is scheduled to come back on before May, but I can reach out to him and see if he can at least do an interview. We can do an interview, the three of us or the four of us, about it.
There'll be a lot coming out of it, and we should be having a chat with him after it.
We are. That's the May 13th schedule. So for exactly that reason, for everyone who's listening to this, peg your calendars for that week in May. I believe the episode drops on Wednesday, which might be the 15th, if I'm remembering correctly. But be sure to listen, because that'll be a fun episode. Louise, what you got this week?
Louise Campbell.
Oh, what have I got? I've been trying to look at some of the data coming out on the performance of FibroScan, obviously, and non-invasive techniques. A, to look at reducing screen failure rates, and B, to look at the measurements going forward, particularly with Resdifera and things like that, to see whether we can pick up those and how it works in comparison. And you'll read one study that goes strongly favour 4 for F2, F3 fibrosis, and some that will be borderline. So again, that doesn't say the school's not out in everything, but I did come across an interesting study looking at the dietary inflammation index in relation to FibroScan. But obviously rating the diets of people, the more inflammatory the diet on the point system that they get, the higher the risk of MAFLD and MASH was, and it was associated with one standard deviation increase in the dietary inflammation index, actually increased the FibroScan score by 0.29 kilopascals. So whether or not also being able to assess the quality of diet that these patients are having. Now, my understanding of the dietary inflammation index is not vast, but there's a number of articles come out this year and late last year in relation to chronic kidney disease, neonatal and pediatric livers. So there seems to be certainly a growing bit of literature coming out on that. And it seems quite complicated in the context of the way that it's recorded through database systems. But I think for big institutions to be able to look at the quality of diets and see whether or not we can predict a little bit more scientifically the correlation in the non-invasive scores with an actual physical score rating the diet, it was new to me. I think I can rate personally some people's diets very well, but it would be interesting to look at the actual science and the scores behind this, because it's been strongly linked to a lot of the syndromes that we already deal with, metabolic syndrome, chronic kidney disease. So yeah, that was an area of bit, and the fact that it has been used with FibroScan. But also what I didn't see in that data was any correlation with CAP, to see whether or not a change, I can often see a fat change quicker than I can see a stiffness change, because we do them on some people so regularly. So you get to see that dynamic aspect of liver health change, both for and against, and that rather rather than just once every 6 months or once every 3 weeks or 3 months, that sort of thing, where it can be just an arbitrary system. So no, that interested me, and it would be interesting, particularly where Jean is placed now, whether or not that's the sort of thing within your holistic type multi-professional unit crossing all of those fields that might be quite beneficial. And no doubt you have all of the kit to be able to analyze and do the dietary inflammation index.
So Luis, I'm going to pull my naive card and I'm going to say, I don't know very much about that index. Can you, do any of you have any more or better information?
Well, I've got some general information. It's a numerical score that assesses the diet and its effect on several biomarkers linked to inflammation. So it goes from somewhere in the region of minus 8.87 to plus 7.98. The more you go negative, the more it is anti-inflammatory, the more it's positive, and the higher the score, the more likely there is inflammation. And it's been linked to many types of cancer, arthritis, cardiovascular disease, bowel diseases, validated. The most recent one, 2014, was the most validated sort of scoring system, and it became a research tool for the study of diet-associated inflammation and health. The thing that it crosses with ours in several areas, inflammatory markers, including interleukin-1, beta, interleukin-4, interleukin-6, interleukin-10, tumor necrosis factors, so reactive CRP. So looking at it, it's linked to a lot of our common syndromes, but also esophageal cancers, colorectal cancers, so cardiovascular disease, depression. We know that MASLD and a lot of liver health issues cause sort of mood swings and depressive illnesses. So it was interesting to just find out how much it crosses with what we do. The piece that I'd pulled up was in BMC Gastroenterology, published on the 8th of April, and it was Massa, Mirian, and the group there, and it was dietary inflammation index in relation to the progression of hepatic steatosis and liver fibrosis evaluation by elastography FibroScan. So the fact that we're able to now associate things like that with FibroScan, which is, for me, FibroScan's an assessment of a liver, then you look for a problem if you see it, and it's more of a dynamic, but we use it very heavily, obviously, but it's how much we can tie liver health to, and this whole aspect of where we improve anything around that could possibly improve our liver health, we tend to see health improvements. So maybe we're giving the liver a break, maybe we're helping in different ways. It is our conductor, it is our superhero. We're looking for something that gives us one particular test. I think it's the holy grail in something that's not designed to show us it's got a problem and can function on so little active tissue. It amazes me every time we sit here and discuss it. But so that was something new to me that might be of use going forward, particularly cross speciality. I'm not an expert. It was my interest of the week.
And now back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page from which you downloaded the conversation, or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. We're working on next week's topic, but it will be at least as good as this week's, maybe even better. Until then, stay safe, surf on. We'll see you on the podcast. Bye-bye now.